You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 9, given in Dornach on the 31st of December, 1921. An important and far-reaching change is taking place when the child begins to shed its milk teeth. This change is not only a physical event in the life of a human being, for the entire human organization undergoes a metamorphosis. A true art of education demands a thorough appreciation and understanding of this metamorphosis. What in our previous meetings I have called the etheric body, or the refined body of formative forces, is becoming freed from certain of its functions during the time between the change of teeth and puberty. Previously, the etheric body has been working directly into the physical body of the child, but now it is beginning to function also in the realm of the child's soul. The effect of this is that the child's physical body is being gripped from within in quite a different manner from that of the previous stage. Previously, the situation was more or less as described by exponents of a materialistic outlook, who see in the physical processes of the human body the foundation of man's psyche. They look upon his soul and spirit as something emanating from the physical, and related to it much as the candle flame is related to the candle. And this is more or less correct with regard to the young child up to the change of teeth. During these early years, the soul and spiritual life of the child is entirely bound up with its physical and organic processes, and all physical and organic processes are at the same time of a soul and spiritual nature. All the shaping and forming of the body, which is going on at that age, is conducted from the head downward. The stage finds its conclusion when the second teeth are being pushed through in the head. At that time, the forces working in the head cease to predominate, while soul and spiritual activities are entering the lower regions of the body, namely the rhythmical activities of heart and breathing. Previously, these forces, working especially upon the formation of the child's brain, were also streaming down into the remaining organism, shaping and molding, and entering directly into the physical substances of the body. Here they brought about physical processes. All this changes with the coming of the second teeth. When certain of these forces begin to work more in the child's soul and spiritual realm, affecting especially the rhythmical movement of heart and lungs, they are no longer active to the same degree in the physical processes themselves, but now they also work in the rhythms of breathing and blood circulation. One can observe this even physically, in that the child's breathing and pulse beat become noticeably stronger at this time. The child now has a strong desire to experience within its own body its emerging life of soul and spirit on waves of rhythm and beat, quite unconsciously, of course. It has a real longing for this interplay of rhythm and beat in its own organism. Consequently, the adult must realize that whatever he or she brings to the child after the change of teeth has to be given with an inherent quality of rhythm and beat. Everything addressed to the child at this time must be imbued with these qualities. The educator has to be able so to live himself into the element of rhythm and beat that whatever he brings will make an impact upon the child, because it is allowed to live in its own musical element. All this is also the beginning of something else. If at this stage the rhythm of breathing and blood circulation is not treated in the right way, the resulting harm may extend irreparably into later life. many weaknesses and unhealthy conditions of the respiratory and circulatory system in adult life are the consequences of a wrong education during these early school years. Through the change in the working of the child's etheric body, the limbs begin to grow rapidly, with the effect that the life of the muscles and bones, that of the entire skeleton, begins to play a predominant role. The life of muscles and bones strives to become attuned to the rhythms of breathing and blood circulation. At this stage, the child's muscles vibrate in sympathy with the rhythms of breathing and blood circulation, so that the entire being of the child takes on a musical character. Whereas previously the child's inborn activities were akin to those of a sculptor, now the inner musician begins to work, albeit beyond the child's consciousness. It is essential for the teacher to realize that when the child enters Class 1, he or she is dealing with a natural, though unconscious, musician. One must meet these inner needs of the child, demanding a somewhat similar treatment, metaphorically speaking, to that of a new violin responding to the playing of a violinist, adapting itself to the characteristic pattern of his sound waves. Through maltreatment, a violin may be ruined once and for all. But in the case of the living human organism, it is possible to implant principles harmful to its growth, which will increase and develop until eventually they can ruin the entire life of the individual concerned. When one has embarked on the study of man, which throws light both on educational principles and methods, one will find that the characteristic features just indicated roughly occupy the time between the change of teeth and puberty. One will also discover that this period of time again falls into three smaller phases. The first one lasts from the change of teeth until approximately the end of the 9th year, the second one roughly until the end of the 12th year, and the third one from the 13th year until sexual maturity has been reached. If one observes how the child lives entirely in a musical element, one can gain insight also into how these three phases differ from one another. During the first phase, that is until approximately the end of the 9th year, the child wants to experience everything that comes toward it within its own inner rhythms, in what belongs to beat and measure. It will relate everything to the rhythms of breath and heartbeat, and indirectly, also, to the way its muscles and bones are shaping themselves. But if the outer influences do not synchronize with its own inner rhythms, the young person will eventually grow into a kind of inner cripple, even if this may not be outwardly discernible in the early stages. Up to its 9th year, the child has the strong desire to experience inwardly, in form of beat and rhythm, everything that comes toward it. When a child of this age hears music, and anyone able to observe what goes on in a child's soul will be able to perceive it, it transforms all the outer sounds into its own inner rhythms. It co-vibrates with the music. It reproduces within what it perceives from without. For at this stage, at least to a certain extent, the child has retained features which are characteristic of its previous stages. Up to the change of teeth, fundamentally, the child is like one sense organ, unconsciously reproducing outer sense impressions as most sense organs do. The child lives above all by imitation, as already shown in previous meetings. Observing the human eye, EYE, leaving out of account any mental images resulting from the eye's sense perceptions, you will find that it reproduces outer stimuli by forming after images. These after images are then taken hold of by the activity leading to mental representation. In as far as the very young child inwardly reproduces all it perceives, especially with regard to the people around it, it is like one great unconscious sense organ. But the images reproduced within do not remain mere images, for they act at the same time as forces, forming and shaping the child, even physically. And now, at the time when the second teeth appear, these after images enter only as far as the rhythmic system, the system of movement. Something of the previous formative activity remains, but now it is accompanied by a new element. There is a definite difference in the way a child responds to rhythm and beat before and after the change of teeth. Before it, by way of imitation, rhythm and beat directly affected the shaping of bodily organs. After the change of teeth, it is transformed into an inner musical element. On completion of the ninth year and up to the 12th year, the child develops an understanding of rhythm and beat, of what belongs to melody in its own right. It now no longer has the same urge to reproduce inwardly all that belongs to this realm, but it begins to perceive it as something outside itself. Whereas earlier on the child experienced rhythm and beat unconsciously, it now develops a conscious perception and understanding of it. This continues up to the 12th year, not only with regard to music, but also to everything else coming to meet it from outside. Toward the 12th year, or perhaps a little earlier, the child develops the ability of leading into the thinking realm the elements of rhythm and beat, which previously it had experienced only imaginatively. If, through insight, one is able to perceive what happens in the realm of the soul, one can also recognize the corresponding effects in the physical body. I have just spoken of how the child wants to shape its muscles, its bones, in accordance with what is happening within its organs. Now, toward the 12th year, the child begins to be no longer satisfied with living solely in the elements of rhythm and beat. Now it wants to lift this experience more into the realm of abstract and conscious understanding. And this coincides with the hardening of those parts of the muscles which lead over into the tendons. Whereas previously all movement was oriented more toward the muscles themselves, it now is oriented toward the tendons. Everything happening in the realm of soul and spirit has its counter effect in the physical realm. And this inclusion of the life of the tendons, that is, of the link between muscle and bone, is the outer physical expression of the child's sailing out of a feeling approach to rhythm and beat into what belongs to the realm of logic, which is devoid of rhythm and beat. A discovery of this kind, an offshoot of a real knowledge of man, needs to be made into a guideline in the art of education. Most adults who think about something in a general way, be it plants or animals, and as teachers you will have to introduce such general subjects to your pupils, will remember that what they themselves once learned in botany or zoology, but at a later age than that of the children we are talking about here. Unfortunately, what you find in most textbooks on botany or zoology is most unsuitable material for teaching the young. Some of these textbooks may be of great scientific merit, though usually this is not the case, but as teaching material for the age which concerns us here, they are of no use at all. For everything which we, as teachers, bring to our pupils in plant or animal study has to be woven into an artistic whole. We must aim at highlighting the harmonious configuration of the plant's being. We must describe the harmonious relationships of one plant species with another. What children can appreciate through a rhythmical, harmonious, and feeling approach has to be of far greater significance for Waldorf teachers than what the ordinary textbooks can offer us. The usual methods of classifying plants is particularly objectionable. Perhaps the least offensive of all is the various systems of all the various systems is that of Lina, who looks only upon the blossom of the plant, that is, to that part where the plant ceases to be merely plant and where it stretches forth its forces into the entire cosmos. But any of these plant systems is unacceptable for use at school at all. We shall see later what needs to be done in this respect. A teacher who, textbook in hand, enters the classroom to teach to younger classes what he himself had learned in botany or zoology is a pitiful sight. If he now strides up and down in front of the desks, reading from his textbook, which in itself is totally unsuitable, in order to refresh his memory of what long ago he himself once learned, he becomes a mere caricature of a teacher. It is absolutely essential for us to learn to talk about plants or animals in a living and artistic way. Only then will our content be attuned to the child's inner musical needs. We must always bear in mind that our teaching must spring from an artistic element. Our lessons must not be merely thought out. Even a correct but abstract kind of observation is not good enough. Only what is imbued with a living element of sensitive and artistic experience will provide the child with the soul nourishment it needs. When children enter class one, and we are expected to teach them writing as soon as possible, we might be tempted to introduce the letters of the alphabet as they are used today. But the forms of these letters are something with which the child of this age, just after the onset of the change of teeth, has not the slightest inner connection. How was it then at the time when such a direct relationship to the written letters still existed? To find the answer, we need only look at what happened in earlier civilizations. In those ancient days, primitive man engraved images on tablets or painted pictures which still bore a resemblance to what he had seen in nature. There still was a direct human link between outer objects and their written forms. As civilization progressed, these forms became more and more abstract until, after having undergone many transformations, they finally emerged as today's letters of the alphabet, which no longer bear any direct human relationship to the person writing them. But the young child, who in many ways shows us how men of earlier civilizations experienced the world, needs a direct connection with whatever we demand from its will activities. Therefore, when introducing writing, we must refrain from teaching today's abstract letter forms straight away. Especially at the time of changing teeth, must we offer the child a human and artistic bridge to whatever we teach. This implies that we allow the child to link what it has seen with its eyes to the result of its own will activity on paper, which we call writing. Experiencing life through its own will activities is a primary need of the child at this stage. We must give it an opportunity to give vent to this innate artistic drive by, for example, letting it run a curve, and there's a diagram. When we draw the child's attention to the fact that its legs have run such a curve on the floor, we lift up its will activity into a semi-conscious feeling. The next step would be to ask the child to draw the curve it had run into the air, using its arm and hand. Now, another form could be run on the floor, again to be written into the air. Thus, the form, which in the first instance was made by the entire body of the running child, was subsequently reproduced merely by the use of its hand. This could be followed by the teacher asking the child to pronounce words beginning with the letter L. Gradually, under his or her guidance, the child will find the link between the shape it has run and drawn and the sound of the appropriate letter, L. Only after the experience of its own inner movement is the child led to the drawing of the actual letters. This would be one way of proceeding, but there is also another possibility. After the change of teeth, the child inwardly is not only a musician, but, as an echo from earlier stages, it has remained also an inner sculptor. Therefore, one can begin by talking to the child about the fish, gradually leading over artistically to its outer form, which the child will draw. Then, appealing to its sense of sound, one directs its attention from the whole word fish to the initial sound F, in this way relating the shape of the letter to its sound. This method, at least to a certain extent, even follows the historical development of the letter F. There is, however, no need to restrict ourselves to actual historical examples. It is certainly right for us to use our own imagination. What matters is not that the child recapitulates the evolution of the actual letters, but that it finds its way into writing through the artistic activity of drawing pictures, which finally will lead to today's abstract letter forms. For instance, one could remind the child of how water makes waves, drawing a picture of this kind and gradually changing it into W. Repeating words such as washing waves of water, waving, washing water, while at the same time drawing the form of a W, one links the sound of the letter W to its written form. Taking one's start with the child's own life experience, one leads over from the activity of drawing to the final letter forms. Following our Waldorf method, the children won't learn to write as quickly as they do in other schools. In the Waldorf school, we hold regular meetings for parents without their children, in which they are invited to discuss the effects of Waldorf education with their teachers. In such meetings, some parents have expressed their anxieties about the fact that their children, even at the age of 8, are still unable to write properly. We have to show them that our slower approach is really a blessing, because it allows the child to integrate the art of writing with its whole being. We try to convince them that in our school the child learns writing at the right age and in a far more humane manner than if it had to absorb something essentially alien to its own nature. Alien because it represents the end product of a long cultural evolution. We must help our parents to see the importance of an immediate and direct response in the child to the introduction of writing. Naturally, we have to provide our pupils with the tools of learning, but we must always do so by adapting our content to the nature of the child. One aspect, so often omitted nowadays, is that of the relationship of a specific area to life as a whole. In our advanced stage of civilization, everything has come to depend on specialization. Certainly, for a time, this was necessary. But we now have reached a stage where, for the sake of mankind's healthy development, we must never lose sight of the totality of life. To do so, we must keep an open mind for what spiritual investigation has to tell us about the human being. To believe that anthroposophists are always railing against new achievements of technology would be a serious misunderstanding of what this movement could contribute toward knowledge of man. For it is necessary to look upon the complexities of life from an holistic point of view. To give you an example, I have not the slightest objection to the use of typewriters. Typing, of course, is a far less human activity than writing by hand. But, as just said, I do not remonstrate against it. Nevertheless, I find it important for us to realize its implications, because everything we do in life has its repercussions. Therefore, you must forgive me if, in order to illustrate my point, I say something about typewriting from the point of view of anthroposophical spiritual insight. Anyone unwilling to accept it is perfectly free to dismiss this aspect of life's realities as foolish nonsense. But what I have to say does accord with actual facts. You see, if one is aware of spiritual processes, which, like those in ordinary life, are always happening around us, typewriting creates a very definite impression. After I have been typing, as you see, I am not fulminating against it at all, but am only pleased if I have time for it, when during the day I have been typing, this activity continues to affect me for quite a long time afterward. This in itself does not disturb me, but the after effects are noticeably there. And when, finally, I reach a state of inner quietude, the activity of typing, seen in imaginative consciousness, becomes transformed into self-beholding. This seeing of oneself stands there before the seer, who is then able to witness outwardly what is happening inwardly. All this must occur in full consciousness, which enables one to recognize that What has thus appeared in form on an outer image is nothing but the projection of what is or has been taking place, possibly at a much earlier time, as an inner organic activity. One can clearly see what is happening inside the human body when one has reached the stage of clairvoyant imagination. In such objective beholding, every pressing of a typewriter key is changed into a flash of lightning. And what appears during the state of imagination as a human heart is constantly being struck and pierced by these flashes of lightning. Now, as you know, the typewriter keys are not arranged according to any spiritual principle, but only according to frequency of use in order to facilitate greater speed in typing. The result is that whenever the fingers hit the various keys, these flashes of lightning become completely chaotic. In short, a frightful thunderstorm is raging when typewriting is seen with spiritual eyes. And what does this mean? It means nothing less than that here we have an explanation of why so many people walk about with weak hearts, for they are unable to balance the damaging effects of typing by appropriate countermeasures. This is especially the case if people started typing at too early an age, at a time when the heart is most liable to be adversely affected. And if typing should spread more and more, one will soon see how all kinds of heart complaints will be on the increase. Causes and effects of this kind are part of the pattern of life. There is no wish on our part to run down any of the new technical inventions, but one ought to be able to look with open eyes at what they do to us. One ought to find the means of compensating for any possible harmful effects. Such matters are of special importance for teachers because they have the task of relating education to practical life. What we do at school or in the company of children is not the only thing that matters. What is of paramount importance is that school and everything pertaining to education is related to life in the fullest sense. And this implies that whoever chooses to be an educator must be familiar with what is happening in the big wide world, must know and recognize life in its widest context. In Germany, the first railway was built from Fürth to Nuremberg in 1835. Before this happened, the health authorities of Bavaria were approached for their opinion as to whether, from a medical point of view, the building of such a railway could be recommended. Before embarking on major projects of this kind, it had always been the custom to seek expert advice. In answer, the Bavarian health authorities stated, and documentary evidence is available, that expert medical opinion could not recommend the building of railways because of the severe strain upon the nervous system which traveling on rails would inflict upon passengers and railway staff alike. However, so the report continued, should railways be built despite the warning of the authorities concerned, all railway lines should at least be fenced off by high wooden walls in order to protect farmers in fields or any others likely to be near traveling trains from suffering concussion of the brain. These were the findings of medical experts employed by the Bavarian health authorities. Today we laugh about them, and many other similar examples could be quoted. Nevertheless, there are at least two sides to each problem, and from a certain point of view one could even agree with some aspects of this report, made not so long ago, in fact, not even a century ago. The fact is that people have become more nervous since the arrival of rail travel. And if we were to make the necessary investigation, to find out the difference between people living in our present age of the train and those who still traveled in the old, venerable, but rather Philistine stagecoach, we would definitely be able to ascertain that the constitutions of the latter were different. Their nervous system behaved quite differently. Though the officials of the Bavarian health authorities have made fools of themselves, from a certain point of view they were not entirely wrong. When new inventions make their impact on modern life, we must take steps to balance any possible ill effects by finding appropriate countermeasures. We must aim at compensating for any weakening of man's constitution due to outer influences, by strengthening him from within. But in this age of ever-increasing specialization, this is only possible through a new art of education based on true knowledge of man. The only safe way of introducing writing to the young child is the one advocated just now, because at that age all learning must proceed from the will sphere, and the child's inclination toward the world of rhythm and measure springs from the will sphere. We must satisfy this inner urge of the child by allowing it controlled will activities, and not by appealing to its sense of observation and an ability to make mental images. From this it follows that it would be wrong to teach reading before the child has been introduced to writing. For reading already represents a transition from a will activity to an abstract observation. The first step is to introduce writing artistically, imaginatively, and then to let the child read what it has written. The last step, since modern life demands it, would be to help the child to read from printed texts. Only by applying a deepened knowledge of man based upon the realities of life is the teacher able to discern what needs to be done. When the child enters Class 1, it is certainly ready to learn how to reckon with simple numbers. But also, in the introduction of arithmetic, one must be careful to meet the inner needs of the child. These spring from the same realm of rhythm and measure, and from a sensitive apprehension of the harmonizing element inherent in the world of number. However, if we begin with what I should like to call the additive approach, if we start by teaching the child to count, we again fail to understand the nature of the child. Of course, it must learn to count, but additive counting in itself is not in harmony with the child's inner needs. Only during the course of civilization has our way of dealing with numbers gradually developed into one of synthesizing, that is, of putting numbers together. Today we have the concept of one unit, of a oneness. We have a second unit, a third unit, and so on. And, when counting, we mentally place one unit next to the other and add them up. But the child's nature does not experience number in the same way, for human evolution did not proceed according to this principle. True, all counting began with a unit, with number one. However, the second unit, number two, was not an outer repetition of the first unit, but it was felt to be contained within the first unit. Number one was the origin of number two, the two units of which were concealed within the original number. The same number one, when divided into three parts, gave number three, and the three units of which were felt to be part of the one. Translated into contemporary terms, when reaching the concept two, one did not leave the bounds of number one, but an inner progression within number one was experienced. The two-ness was inherent in the oneness. Also three, four, and all other numbers were felt to be part of the all-comprising first unit, and all numbers were experienced as organic members arising out of it. Due to its musical, rhythmical nature, the child, too, experiences the world of number in a similar way. Therefore, instead of beginning by adding, in a rather pedantic way, it would be better to call out a child and give it some apples or any other suitable objects. Instead of giving it, say, three apples, then four more, and finally another two, asking the child to add them all together, one begins by giving it a whole pile of apples, or whatever is convenient. This would be the start of the whole operation. Then one calls out two more children and says to the first one, quote, "Here you have a heap of apples. Give some to the other two children and keep some for yourself. But each one of you must have the same number of apples." Close quote. In this way you help the child grasp the idea of sharing by three. One begins with the total amount and leads to the principle of division. Following this method, the child will respond and apprehend this process quite naturally. According to our picture of man, and in order to be attuned to the child's nature, we do not begin by adding numbers, but by dividing and subtracting them. Then, retracing our steps and thus reversing the first two processes, we are led to multiplication and addition. Moving from the whole to the part, we follow the original number experience, which was one of analyzing, that is, of a divisional quality, and not the contemporary method of synthesizing, of putting things together, of adding. These are some examples to show how one can read in the development of the child what and how one ought to teach during the different stages. Breathing and blood circulation are the physical bases of the life of feeling, just as the head is the basis for mental imagery, for thinking. With the change of teeth, the life of feeling becomes liberated, and therefore at this stage, one can always reach the child through the element of feeling, provided that the teaching material is artistically attuned to the child's nature. To sum up, before the change of teeth, the child is not yet aware of its separate identity, and consequently it cannot appreciate the characteristic nature of other persons, whose gestures, manners of speaking, and even whose sentiments it imitates in an imponderable way. Up to the 7th year, the child cannot yet differentiate between its own self and that of another person. It experiences others as something with which it is intimately connected, similar to the way in which it feels connected with its own arms and legs. It does not yet make a distinction between self and the surrounding world. With the change of teeth, new soul forces of feeling linked to breathing and blood circulation come into their own, with the effect that the child begins to distance itself from other people, whom it now experiences as individual characters. And this creates in the child a longing to follow the grown-up in every way, and to look up to the adult in shy reverence. The child's previous inclination to imitate the more external features changes after the 2nd dentition. True to the child's nature, a strong feeling for authority begins to develop. You will hardly expect a ready sympathy for general obedience to authority from someone who, as a young person, published titled The Philosophy of Spiritual Activity early in the 1890s, readers aside, also known as Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, and also known as The Philosophy of Freedom, end readers aside. But this sense for authority in the child between the change of teeth and puberty must be respected and nurtured, because it represents an inborn need at this age. Only those who have experienced shy reverence and a feeling of authority for the adult between their change of teeth and puberty can in later life use their freedom rightly. This is another example showing how education must be seen within the context of the social life in general. If you look back a few decades and see how proud many people then were of their, in quotes, modern educational ideas, some strange feelings will begin to stir in you. After the victory of Prussia over Austria in 1866, one often heard a remark in Austria, where I spent half of my life. People expressed the opinion that the battle had been won by the Prussian schoolmaster. Austria, where the Education Act was implemented later than in Prussia, was always considered to have an inferior education system, and the Prussian schoolmaster was hailed as having won the victory. However, after 1918, one no longer sang the praises of the Prussian schoolmaster. This is an example to show how modern educational attitudes have been praised for the most extraordinary successes. And today we witness some of the results, namely our chaotic social life, which threatens to become more and more chaotic because so many people have replaced a will-controlled and morally strong sense of freedom by indulgence and license. Many of them have forgotten how to make use of their real inner freedom. Whoever is able to observe life will find definite links between the general chaos of today and educational principles which, though highly satisfying to intellectual and naturalistic attitudes, will fail to bring about the full development of the human being. One must become aware of the polar effects in life, such as that man in his later life can become free in the right way only if, as a child, he has gone through a stage of looking up to and of revering his elders. It is wholesome for the child to believe that a thing is beautiful, true, and good, or ugly, false, and evil, if and because the teacher says so. With a change of teeth, the child gains a new relationship to the world. As the life of its own soul gradually emerges, which the child now experiences as something in its own right, it has to meet the world first of all supported by the feeling of authority. At this stage, the educator represents the world at large, and the child has to meet it through the eyes of its teacher. Therefore, we have to say, from birth to the change of teeth, instinctive imitation. From the change of teeth to puberty, principle of authority. But by authority, we mean the child's natural response to its teacher, and never an enforced authority. It is the kind of authority which, in quite intangible ways, creates the right rapport between child and teacher. And here we enter the realm of imponderables. I should like to show you by way of an example how they work. Let us imagine that we wish to give the child a concept of the immortality of the soul, a task which is a good deal more difficult than one may suppose. At the age we are speaking of, an age in which the child is so open to the artistic element in education, we cannot communicate such a concept by abstract reasoning or by means of ideas. We must clothe it in pictures. Now, how might a teacher, one who feels drawn to the more intellectual and naturalistic side of life, proceed? Subconsciously, he may say to himself, "Naturally, I am more intelligent than the child, who in reality is stupid. Therefore, I must invent a suitable picture in order to give the child an idea of the immortality of the human soul." The chrysalis, from which the butterfly emerges, offers a good metaphor. The butterfly is hidden in the chrysalis. In the body, the human soul is hidden. The butterfly flies out of the chrysalis. This is a visible picture of what happens in death, when the supersensible soul leaves the body to fly into the spiritual world. This is the kind of idea which a skillful, though intellectually inclined person, might have thought out in order to pass on to the child the concept of the immortality of the soul. But with such an attitude of mind, the child will not feel inwardly touched. It will accept this picture and soon afterward forget it again. However, one could approach the same task in a different manner. For it is quite wrong to feel, quote, "I am intelligent and the child is stupid," close quote. We have already seen in the course of our deliberations how cosmic wisdom is still working directly through the child, and that from this point of view it is the child who is intelligent and the teacher who is stupid. This I can bear in mind, and I can fully believe in the picture of the emerging butterfly. A spiritual attitude to the world teaches me to believe in the truth of this picture, which tells me the same process which, on a higher plane, signifies the soul's withdrawal from the body, is repeated on a lower level, in a simplified and sense-perceptible form, when a butterfly emerges from the chrysalis. This picture is not an invention of mine, but it has been placed into the world by powers of cosmic wisdom. Here, before my very eyes, I can behold what, on a higher plane, happens when the soul leaves the body in death. If this picture makes a deep impression upon my soul, I cannot but feel convinced of its truth. If the teacher has such an experience, something begins to stir between his pupils and him or herself, something which can be assigned only to the realm of the imponderables. If with the warmth and inwardness of his belief the teacher brings this picture to the child, it will create a deep and lasting impression. It will become part of the child's being. If one can look upon the effects of natural authority, leading to an obedience of a most inward kind, in a similar light, then authority will be accepted as something wholesome and positive, then it will not be resented by a mistaken idea of freedom. And so the teacher, as artist in the field of education, has to stand before the child as an artist of life also, because after the change of teeth, the child approaches him as an artist too, namely as a sculptor and a musician. In certain cases, these unconscious and inherent gifts of the child are developed to a specially high degree, namely in those children who, in later life, become virtuosi or geniuses. Such individuals never lose their former artistic gifts. But inwardly, though entirely unconsciously, every child is a great sculptor. Children retain these gifts from the time before the change of teeth. After this, the inner musical activities are woven together with the inner sculptural formative activities. As educators, we must learn to cooperate in a living way with these artistic forces working through the child. Proceeding along these lines, it is possible to prevent rampant growth in the young human being. Then we shall enable him to develop his potential in the widest possible sense. The end of Lecture 9.